Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Abby Maxman, CEO of Oxfam America, and Dr. Karama Kumaral of Harvard Medical School, and a member of Doctors Against Genocide, who discuss the rapidly worsening humanitarian disaster in Gaza. Mazen Kumsia, founder of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability at Bethlehem University, who talks about the repression and violence that impacts daily life for Palestinians living in the West Bank. And Rick Perlstein, journalist, historian, and author, who criticizes U.S. corporate media coverage of the 2024 presidential election campaign as riven by journalistic malpractice. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new proxy war between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo has flared up in recent weeks as Congo's army and the Rwandan-backed M23 Tutsi-led rebels in eastern Congo killed scores and displaced hundreds of thousands. The decades-long war has increased the risk of an all-out conflict between Congo and Rwanda that could draw in neighbors and regional powers, including South Africa, Burundi, Uganda, Tanzania, and Malawi. Reuters reports that in the past few weeks, the rebels have been closing in on eastern Congo's largest city, Goma, and have blocked the main roads. The government of Congo, United Nations officials, and Western powers, including the U.S. and Belgium, have accused Rwanda of providing support for M23. For its part, Rwanda has blamed the escalation on Congo officials threatening to invade Rwanda and Congo's decision to end the mandate of regional peacekeepers. There are more than 16,000 UN peacekeepers in Congo, and the 16-member Southern African Development Community approved a military mission to eastern Congo to defend against armed groups, with South Africa pledging to contribute 2,900 troops to the force. Colombia will host the 2024 United Nations Biodiversity Summit in the city of Cali this fall. There, nations are expected to announce their plans on their conservation goals and negotiate on climate finance. At last year's COP28 climate summit in Dubai, Colombia's leftist president, Gustavo Petro, announced that his nation would be the first significant oil exporter to call for a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty. Such a treaty would commit nations to move away from fossil fuels to transition to clean energy while also guaranteeing that they have the money to do so. Colombia also joined Kenya and France at the summit to launch an expert panel that will publish data on how sovereign debt impacts the ability of nations to meet their climate goals. Upon taking office in August 2022, Petro halted new oil exploration contracts and ramped up efforts to slow deforestation in Colombia's section of the Amazon rainforest. Petro's climate diplomacy has put pressure on other Latin American leaders, including Brazil's President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, to back away from oil and gas exploration and drilling in the fragile Amazon region. The headwaters of the Muddy River, a tributary of the Colorado River, relies on groundwater-fed springs as its primary supply as it flows to Lake Mead. But over the last two decades, those springs have faced the threat of groundwater overuse. As reported by Barn Raiser Media, the state of Nevada issued more rights to use groundwater than there was water to allocate. When too much groundwater is pumped, it can deplete the springs feeding the Muddy, with cascading effects on people and wildlife that rely on that river. In 2018, developers moved forward with a plan to build Coyote Springs, a master-planned community outside Las Vegas that needed to pump large quantities of water for its residents. The state and the Southern Nevada Water Authority, which controls water rights on the Muddy River, raised concerns and issued Order 1309, which determined that the available amount of water that can be pumped was substantially lower than the state had issued in the past. Developers and other interests sued in district court to stop the state's Order 1309 and won their case in 2022. But in late January, Nevada's Supreme Court overturned the ruling, giving Nevada's water regulators clear authority in managing the depletion of groundwater, empowering the state to adjust decisions in the public interest based on evolving science. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
More than 31,000 Palestinians have now been killed in Gaza, with tens of thousands wounded, since the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack on Israel that killed 1,200 Israelis and kidnapped 240 hostages. International negotiators working to broker a six-week Gaza ceasefire have thus far failed. As Israel blocks most aid from entering Gaza, parents are struggling to feed their children. As of March 12th, Gaza's health ministry reported that at least 25 Palestinians have starved to death, with most of those dying children. International aid organizations and UN officials have been warning for months that Israel's siege and blockade of the territory was plunging Gaza's 2.3 million residents into widespread famine. In advance of his March 7th State of the Union speech, President Biden ordered U.S. military cargo planes to airdrop thousands of meals into Gaza. Humanitarian aid groups condemn Israel for blocking most aid trucks from entering Gaza by land and said the U.S. airdrop was grossly insufficient. Biden's more recent order to the Pentagon to build a temporary floating dock on Gaza's coast to speed up humanitarian shipments could take as long as 60 days, as Palestinians continue to starve. Your reporter spoke with Abby Maxman, Oxfam America's president and CEO, and Dr. Karama Kumaral of Boston's Children's Hospital, an assistant professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School, and a member of the group Doctors Against Genocide. Here they discuss the worsening humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza and growing pressure on President Biden to urgently act to stop the bloodshed and prevent famine.
The situation in Gaza is really, I'm running out of adjectives to be able to describe it. I have 29 staff who are currently there. They are also displaced and working heroically every day, not only to provide immediate needs for their family and loved ones and strangers, but providing aid. And I think you know, but almost 2 million people have been displaced under the gravest hostilities imagined, and many of them forcibly displaced multiple times, my staff included, and Oxfam staff. Now, Gaza's healthcare capacity is in ruins. There's no access to clean water, concerns and reports repeatedly of dehydration, waterborne diseases. And the risk of famine is imminent. We have been sounding the alarms for months now, and we know that people are dying of starvation. Starvation is being used as a weapon of war, and Palestinians in Gaza aren't starving. They are being starved. What we really need is a ceasefire, the safe return of all hostages, and immediate and urgent access to humanitarian aid. And anything less than that is really a Band-Aid over a gaping wound. And people need virtually everything. And not enough is getting in, and we'd have the ability to get so much in quickly if the bombing stopped.
Thank you for that, Abby. Appreciate that. And I wanted to ask you, Dr. Kumaral, to talk about, as a physician, what we're seeing unfold with malnutrition and starvation in Gaza. It's horrifying to see some of these, especially the children, who are gaunt and look like pictures out of World War II concentration camps. It's I can't believe this is happening, and I think many Americans feel the same way.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for bringing this subject to light. The population is starving. 25 people have died from starvation, mostly children and older people. The rise in malnutrition amongst children, pregnant women, and breastfeeding women is so sharp, it is unprecedented. The death happens because of both malnutrition and dehydration. We are seeing a mass killing of children in slow motion because there is no food left and nothing is getting to the children. It's a warning from Save the Children. Pregnant women who are malnourished give birth to children with intrauterine growth retardation. So the babies are much smaller than they should be. The babies are born with multi-organ disease because malnutrition can affect wound healing. It can affect the cardiac system. It can affect the liver. And it can also cause long-term mental illness. There is a much higher incidence of schizophrenia in children who are born to malnourished mothers who suffer from intrauterine growth retardation. There is correlation between malnutrition before birth and shortly after birth and long-term incidence of diseases like metabolic syndrome, which is insulin-dependent diabetes, sometimes obesity, sometimes, again, liver dysfunction. So we are seeing a full range of diseases that are in the making because of this famine starvation situation. The food scarcity has affected everybody, especially in the north, where people are having to eat animal food and they ran out of it. The situation is unprecedented. I think it's very difficult for us to imagine it, but we know that it's happening.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Kumaral. Abby, I did want to ask you from the perspective of someone who heads up Oxfam America. We've recently heard Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu talk about his plan is on track for a military offensive targeting the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where 1.5 million Palestinians were directed to flee by Israel to seek safety from the conflict. But yet we're in a time period right now where Israel may attack this place where throngs of refugees are seeking refuge.
A further offensive in Rafah is horrifying to consider. It will surely accelerate this deepening humanitarian crisis, hunger crisis, everything that we've been describing. The trauma people are experiencing, they have been relocated and relocated, and they have nowhere to go. Without a ceasefire, we will see significantly increased loss of civilian life. There have been more aid workers killed in this period over the past 5 months than most other collective crises that we've seen in years. And we need the ceasefire. It is simply impossible for any and all parts of the international humanitarian system to work safely to distribute aid and help protect the lives of civilians. This has got to stop, and we are calling the Biden administration to use all its power and influence to require a significant change and to not have an offensive on Rafah. That would be absolutely devastating.
That was Abby Maxman, Oxfam America's president and CEO, and Dr. Karama Kumaral of Boston Children's Hospital, assistant professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School, and a member of the group Doctors Against Genocide. Find more analysis and commentary on the catastrophic humanitarian crisis in Gaza by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the world watches the numbers of killed and injured Palestinians climb daily in Gaza, as of March 12th, the dead number more than 31,000, the media spotlight hasn't focused much on the crisis in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, where 2.9 million Palestinians live ever more threatened, circumscribed lives. The violence and repression from both the Israeli army and Israeli settlers ramped up in the West Bank in the immediate aftermath of the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack on southern Israel. At least 275 Palestinians, including 63 children, have been killed in the West Bank since October 7th. Tensions are now also rising between Israel and the Lebanese armed militia group Hezbollah, where an escalation in cross-border airstrikes and rocket attacks increase the danger of a wider regional war. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mazen Kumsia, professor and founder and volunteer director of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability at Bethlehem University. Here he describes the repression and violence impacting daily life for Palestinians in the West Bank and outlines what supporters of Palestine can do to address the injustice and oppression.
The West Bank is basically a bunch of Bantustans or ghettos or concentration camps. Since 7 October 2023, for the past 5+ months, we've been cooped up in these concentration areas and roads are blocked. Israel allows settlers to rampage in the West Bank, killing a lot of Palestinians, both by settlers and soldiers. I think it's like 80 children so far have been killed, and demolishing homes. 22 communities have been ethnically cleansed in the West Bank. So the situation is horrible also in the West Bank, not just in Gaza, but at least we don't have mass starvation in the West Bank like is happening in Gaza. Even though the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics just came up with numbers in terms of the disastrous state of the economy here. In total, between the West Bank and Gaza, in the first 4 months of this conflict, Palestinian economy lost $2.3 billion. Most people are unemployed and cannot provide for their families in the West Bank because 150,000 used to work in Israel, another 150,000 used to work in the tourism industry. All of this is shut down. In Gaza, of course, everything is shut down.
You said villages had been ethnically cleansed. Say more about that.
Well, the Israeli military took the preoccupation of the world with Gaza and came here in the West Bank and started removing some Palestinians from their homes and lands, kicking them out, destroying their homes. So 22 communities were removed. They were housing more than 3,000 people. So they came and destroyed their houses, their tents, their caves, even some Bedouins in caves and tents and houses. They removed them. The South Hebron Hill villagers were removed. Most of them were removed. So that's natural for colonizers, sort of like what the U.S. did with Native Americans.
So what does it look like in terms of political repression or being able to go out on the street? Can you go out and oppose the war in Gaza safely?
No, really. Even those with Israeli citizenship, Jews and non-Jews, are attacked, beaten, jailed for trying to say stop the genocide in Gaza or declare ceasefire. So they have been under tremendous pressure. And many lost their jobs even for posting on Facebook items related to ceasefire or negotiate now or stop the genocide or anything like that.
As you know, there's been a lot of uproar in the U.S. From my perspective, it seems to be very, you know, weighted on the ceasefire side, on the, you know, Palestinian side. What's the best thing that people who want a ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire and justice for Palestinians throughout, you know, the Palestinian territories, what do you think is the best thing that people could be doing?
Well, they need to challenge their politicians. They need to engage in civil disobedience. They need to write to the media. They need to engage in boycott, divestment, sanctions of Israeli products that are in American markets, like dates and stuff like that. They need to write and speak to other people, mobilize more people. We are millions on the streets, but we need to be hundreds of millions around the world. without noise, without speaking, without posting on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Telegram. People can do that. It doesn't take too much time to keep posting, keep showing the videos of the genocide that's ongoing in Gaza.
That was Professor Mazen Qumsia, founder and director of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability at Bethlehem University in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Find more news and information on the situation in the West Bank by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As both the Democratic and Republican parties end their primary season and certified their preordained nominees for president, U.S. corporate media has largely normalized their coverage of the campaign, despite Donald Trump's divisive platform, pledging to impose an authoritarian regime should he win in November. Speaking at rallies and during friendly right-wing media interviews, Trump talks about being a dictator on day one of his presidency, proposes deploying the military against Americans opposed to his policies, purging the federal workforce of anyone not loyal to him, and implementing the largest domestic deportation operation in American history. Trump, who faces 91 felony charges in 4 cases, quotes Hitler, praises authoritarian leaders, claims immigrants are poisoning the blood of our country, and labels his political opponents as vermin. Like many of his Republican allies, Trump embraces political violence and praises the violent January 6 insurrectionists he incited to attack the Capitol as heroes and patriots. Yet, as is often the case with U.S. corporate media, many reporters and editors are on the defensive against charges that they're the liberal media, so they regularly frame their coverage of the election campaign with false equivalents in both sidesism, telling the same old Democrats versus Republicans story. This timid reporting thus normalizes Donald Trump's agenda to demolish the nation's democratic institutions. Your reporter spoke with Rick Perlstein, a journalist, conservative movement historian, and New York Times bestselling author, who criticizes U.S. corporate media coverage of the 2024 presidential election campaign as riven by journalistic malpractice.
The easiest way to describe the way, what I call the agenda setting elite political journalists, right? So I'm talking about, you know, the people who the rest of the journalists look to for cues. The way to describe the way they're covering the 2024 election is that they're covering it exactly as if it were the, you know, 1996 election, that they're using very ossified, very rigid genre conventions that have been in place for a very long time, even though they don't describe the reality we're actually facing. Because of the march towards authoritarianism of the Republican Party, both sides journalism, and I say this very adamantly and try to get it across in every interview, is biased towards the Republicans. Because if you think about it, if you're, you know, kind of honor bound to give equal sides and equal respect to both what the Republicans do and the Democrats, and one side habitually and institutionally lies, cheats, and steals, and the other side, for all their flaws, kind of, well, this is one of their flaws, you know, behave like Boy Scouts, right? And you're saying that they're both equally responsible for the problem, then you're biased towards the side that lies, cheats, and steals.
I think it was last week I was listening to an NPR interview on threats to democracy. And the person they had on, I think, was, you know, very knowledgeable and had some strong points of view about the threats to democracy. And they went through the issues of gerrymandering, voter suppression, threats of election results being subverted, supermajority legislatures removing long-held powers from governors, overturning results of referendum votes. The problem with this interview was she did not mention the Republican Party once as being the culprit in most, if not all, of these issues of threats to democracy.
Yeah, they have a synonym for the Republican Party on National Public Radio. It's Congress. right? Because they always say, you know, Congress is blocking X,
right?
Or Congress is, you know, log jammed, or Congress can't move any legislation, or Congress is increasingly extreme. You know, I mean, this is really getting to the point of, you know, you're a Soviet citizen and you're reading Pravda, or you literally cannot approach reality with reporting like this. It does not describe the world that's all around us. The First Amendment was created in order to create a space for journalism as a civic institution, right? Not as a business. One of the first laws that Congress passed, also in the 18th century, subsidized postage for newspapers, so it was almost impossible for them to go out of business. Right, so if these guys are supposedly originalists, you know, I'd like to go back to those original principles because, you know, quite frankly, unless you're informing citizens in what they need to know to dispose their duties and obligations as citizens, then you're really not doing journalism as it was meant to be done in a free society.
Well, I have one final question for you, and it has to do with the important question of how media should be covering this election. What's your view of what media could do to improve their coverage in these next 7 months?
Well, I think that there has to be a lot more discussion of policy. You know, there's always good journalism. It's like what I.F. Stone used to say. The New York Times is a great newspaper because you never know on what page you'll find a front page story, right? There's always people who kind of sneak in really good stuff. But the people who are the agenda setters, you know, the people who, you know, set the narrative, you know, tend to follow these, you know, morbid routines that I've described. So, you know, what they need to do is, you know, move the critical stuff that they bury onto the front page, you know, tell the truth as they see it without fear or favor and devil take the hindmost. That's always a good principle. You know, if one candidate is, you know, kind of sane and responsible and the other campaign is, you know, insane and irresponsible, you know, if you say that, you're describing reality. You're not being biased.
That was Rick Perlstein, a journalist, conservative movement historian, and New York Times bestselling author of books, including Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. Find links to his recent articles on media election coverage by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.